Welcome to EIR Talks. On February 17, 2002, the president and founder of the International Schiller Institute, Helga Zeplerush, addressed its President's Day conference in Reston, Virginia. Over 1,000 attendees were present. This week, we bring you part one of her presentation, The Dialogue of Cultures.
Should I just start? Thank you very much, Emilia. You always warm our hearts with your beautiful poetical descriptions. Now, I want to discuss today how to defeat this evil policy of the clash of civilization. And indeed, if you look at the happenings in the Middle East, in the Gulf region, and elsewhere, one can actually see that the danger of the world plunging into a clash of civilization is very big. And I still remember the words of the former head of the CIA, Woolsey, who immediately after the September 11th said that the war against terrorism would last maybe 100 years. Now, if this would happen, and you would have a war of 100 years, there is no question that the world would plunge into a new dark age, and we would have a global religious war, an always perpetuating war. And it is already clear that after the bombing of Afghanistan, the fuse to this clash of civilization has been lit. Contrary to what the media are trying to tell you, trying to brainwash the population, nothing has been solved in Afghanistan. As a matter of fact, the German TV openly said if the foreign troops would leave, the Taliban would be back in 6 days. And when we were in India in December, Mr. LaRouche and I, the Indians expressed very strongly, they said, what crazy idea is it that you want to eliminate fundamentalism by throwing bombs on it? You just make it worse. And it is very clear what Lynn outlined yesterday that, you know, contrary to what is being said, the clash of civilization is the real intent of these policies. Already the entire region is a powder keg. And therefore, everybody in Europe knows that if these policies, which were pronounced by President Bush in the State of the Union address, the so-called axis of evil of supposedly Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, if this would be indeed carried out, this region would blow up, and therefore you have an unprecedented wave of protest from Germany, from France, from many politicians in other European countries, because they for sure don't want that, because they can see very clearly that contrary to the propaganda, that any such attack on Iraq, leave alone Iran or North Korea, would mean a strategic crisis with Russia. And all of this in the context of the financial meltdown would lead to an uncalculable situation where the outcome could very easily be World War III. Therefore, what I'm going to talk about today, the need for a dialogue of cultures as a way to defeat the clash of civilization, is one of the most urgent questions of civilization today. And I think it is important to study what are these civilizations we are talking about, how can you understand them, and how can you see that the idiotic thesis of the evil Samuel Huntington about the clash of civilization is actually an idiotic wrong idea. Because what it is based on is the idea on the axiom that all the different cultures and religions and civilizations are completely different, that they are absolutely not united by universal principles common to all of them, and therefore, because they have nothing in common, a war among them is eventually inevitable. What Samuel Huntington says in this book, that Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, Confucianism, and so forth, are all fundamentally different and separate. Now, I don't know if you read this book. If you do, you have to somehow eat something first because your stomach will turn around. And the problem is that you know, books always reflect the mind of the author. And when you read this book, you see immediately this author has an extremely ugly mind. It's the same ugly mind which comes out in this other book, The Soldier and the State, where he discusses the role of the army in relation to civil society and why a professional army, which blindly is obedient and where the soldiers are the legions holding together the empire, is actually what is desirable. And most revealing is that, you know, he says that the good example of a soldier who is not thinking but just obeying orders is the Reichswehr, which did not oppose Hitler coming to power in 1933. And a bad example of what the soldier should not be is the resistance of the 20th of July. I mean, that much for his mindset. Now, you have in the recent months an open discussion in the New York Times and elsewhere that there should be a global American empire. So what H.G. Wells in his Open Conspiracy developed, and which has unfortunately polluted the minds of generations of establishment figures in the United States ever since, namely that there should be a world empire, this policy has now come out of the closet. Now, the entire control of such an idea, to have a new empire dominated by especially the United States, but also the Anglo-Americans, depends on this axiom that there are no universal ideas among the different cultures. Because only then can you keep control, keep them separate, keep them manipulated. Now, this is not anything terribly new, because if one studies the books of the British historiography, it is absolutely amazing what gigantic effort the British historians have made in the last three centuries to prove that all the cultures have developed completely autochthonous, autarkical, and they have not influenced each other. Now, if people believe that, then obviously it is extremely easy to manipulate them. And you all, or some of you, remember that at a certain point you may have had a fight with a person, and you were the real opponent of this person in this moment. And then, you know, your mind tends to just make up a list of negative points of this person. And, you know, you think of this person and you just think these negative points. And then eventually, when you want to end this fight and overcome the conflict, you have to remember that the person does not consist of this list of negative points, but that there are actually common grounds which unite you with this person, and that there is a higher level of reason which you can relate to. Now, in a similar way, this is how you have to approach the different cultures, because if you only focus on the negative points, then there is always a place and room for conflict. Now, this dialogue can also not be just in the form of a nominalist way, but you have to approach it from the standpoint of universal history, namely from a standpoint which the British say does not even exist. But I can assure you that among insiders, universal history is the hottest issue in town. When one tries to develop this idea of the dialogue of cultures based on universal history, I still think that Nicolaus of Cus is the best reference point. I already referred to this beautiful call for a dialogue among cultures in my call last October. But since there are many new people listening today, I want to quickly go into this dialogue here again. It's called De Pace Fidei, about peace in religion. And it was written in 1453, after the fall of Constantinople to the Turks, which one can say was an earlier clash of civilization, and it caused big fears in all of Europe about what had happened. And the reports about bloodshed, rapings, killings, and so forth came. And Nicolaus of Cus, who just had been previously in Constantinople, then writes, under the impression of this very lofty, beautiful dialogue, where the representatives of 17 religions and nations go to God, to the divine verb, and say, we are all fighting each other, killing each other in your name, and that cannot be your intention. Can you please help us to overcome this problem? So God, the divine verb, says, well, you all are wise men, sages of your religions, and therefore you can all understand that there is only one truth. And the wise men say, yes, we all know this, there is only one truth, but why do we still fight? And then God says, well, you make the mistake to mistake the word of the prophets with the word of God. And they can easily see that the word of God is of a higher value than the word of all the prophets. But we still fight. So he says, well, you make another mistake, that you mistake the truth with tradition. The truth is one, but the traditions are many. So the wise men all agree and say, well, we all agree, but how can we now go back to our people and tell them they should believe in a new religion when they have shed so much blood for the old one? And then God says, well, I'm not asking you to preach a new religion. I'm talking about the one religion which was before and above all other religions. Now go to your people and teach them that truth. Now, Nicolaus applied here the concrete case, in the concrete case of religious war, what was his deepest conviction from his first sermon, which he preached in 1430, that there is a multitude of voices for the one truth. This was the humanist tradition which believed that there exists a continuous original wisdom of all people, a prisca theologica, an old, very wise theology above the different ones. Now let us investigate if evidence of this can be found in the different religions. Let us first go to one of the cradles of mankind, to India and Hinduism, where we find a continuous civilization of at least 8,000 years, but probably much, much longer. And here in the oldest Indian writings, in the Rig Veda, which are the earliest Hindu writings, we find the famous sentence about the one truly divine with the many names. The truth is one. The sages only give it different names. In Hinduism, there is the deep recognition that the one divine truth does not give privilege to one language or culture, that the one truth is not the possession of anybody alone, but that this truth shines differently in different souls. There is the, I hope I pronounce this correctly, Sanatana Dharma, the eternal religion, which is even more than the Hindu Dharma and more than any other religion. This eternal religion is understood as behind all religions, or as Kusa would say, above all religions. Dharma also signifies the eternal order which governs both the cosm and the moral law of man, an idea very similar to the concept of the macrocosm, microcosm in Nicolaus of Kus. Mahatma Gandhi himself saw himself as a Sanatana Hindu, respecting at the same time the truth of the other religions. Hinduism is not a missionary religion, but it is guided by the deep conviction that the other person or religion has his own way of reaching the way to God. It is even considered blasphemism if a person thinks that he or she can usurp what the one truth is with a single notion for herself alone. If one takes the color of one's own spectacle for the only color to exist, one can only see the imposed color and not the object as such. One has to understand that God deliberately created the many colors and that the multitude is wished by God. The very famous creation song, and very beautiful, of the creation song of the Rig Veda describes the creation of the universe as resting before all creation in the original oneness, out of which then the divine creator emanates and creates the universe. In the fourth verse of this creation song, the idea is expressed that the first seed of thinking was the desire for love, and that the sages reached in their heart, and in reflecting in this way, they found the original existence of the non-existent. Now remember, this aspect of Indian cosmogony, when we later come to the Egyptian myth of creation. In the Hindu writings, the Rig Veda roughly can be compared to the Old Testament. Even in Hinduism, there is no binding texts like the Bible or the Quran. And the Upanishads could be compared with the New Testament. Of all the very interesting concepts I could talk about, I only want to pick two ideas of, on the one side, the absolute Brahman with distinctive features, which is called the Saguna Brahman, and on the other side, that aspect which is beyond all distinctive features, which is called the Nirguna Brahman. This Brahman, without specific attributes, is the highest form of conscience. It is exactly what Nicolaus of Cusa discusses with the negative theology, which Nicolaus of Cusa calls the non-other, namely that you cannot give any positive name to God because it diminishes the greatness of God, and that you can only describe God as being non-other, that the non-other is non-other than the non-other. The majority of people need a personal God with attributes, and in Hinduism this is called Ishvara, who also gives grace to the people. Hinduism in the later period, represented by the big epics Ramayana, Mahabharata and the Bhagavad Gita, which was the most favorite book of Gandhi, made this ideal of the Saguna Brahman the most popular form of Hinduism. Now, there was a change in the use of the notion of God from the older Rig Veda to the Upanishads. Now God is not one God, but it is the omnipotent, omniscient one. He is in us, besides us, and above us. Now, we will see this later in the Egyptian concepts, and it is also the Cusa idea of the quod libet in quo libet, that everything is in everything. This God in the Upanishads cannot be comprehended through speech, thinking, nor seeing, only through the words, he is. The idea that all notions of dualism and multitudes are confusion, and only the negation of all positive descriptions, all determination has to be negated, that this all the more if one refers to the one truth, the absolute Brahman. Some of the key concepts in Hinduism are very similar to what we find in Christianity. First, that there is an eternal religion above the specific traditions of religions, as expressed in De Pace Fide. Second, that the true character of God cannot be described with positive adjectives, the non-other negative theology of Cusa. Third, that man participates in God's nature, the idea of imago Dei in Christianity, man in the image of God. And fourth, that according to the creation song of the Vedic, love and intellect belong together, which is the Christian idea of agape. What other evidence do we have of this original wisdom? Existing in all of mankind's history, the idea of an enduring tradition of noble truth. St. Augustine, in the seventh book of his Confessions, talks about the cohesion between Christianity and philosophy. The Neoplatonics, he says, would have said nearly all with the same words what is said in the book of St. John. The unity and oneness of God. the creation of the world through the Logos, the enlightenment and creation of the human soul through the Logos. Only the incarnation of God and the redemption of man through Christ's death would be missing, said Augustine. In the already mentioned sermon by Nicolaus of Cus from 1430, Nicolaus quotes this passage of Augustine and then elaborates the cohesion of the prologue of St. John with the general human tradition of wisdom. Nicolaus adds that not only the Neoplatonics had recognized God as Logos, that already Hermes Trismegistus would have recognized nearly the whole truth and would have described the power and majesty of the Logos. Now, for Nicolaus, the writings attributed to Hermes Trismegistus were an expression of a very, very old, ancient wisdom out of which Moses and the Platonics would have drawn. Nicolaus' conviction was that this wisdom would be the common basis of all the multitude of human history, and that therefore the diversifying views could be all brought back in their convergence. Now, who was this Hermes Trismegistus? And I must say, this notion, this person is known to me for a long time because Nicolaus quotes him all the time. But in the recent period, I looked more closely and I was completely intrigued about this person, or maybe not person. Here we come to one of the most fascinating stories of ancient and modern history, and to the absolute dividing line between the British Empire faction and the humanist tradition. About this question erupted during the last 25 years, one of the biggest freakouts among historians ever, the famous Black Athena debate about a book which was published first in 1987 by Martin Bernell, discussing the Egyptian roots of the classical Greek and therefore the European civilization. The controversy about this book was so big, and still is, that, for example, a certain John R. Lenz wrote in the magazine Free Inquiry, "Not since the Old Testament has a book about the second millennium BC generated so much controversy as Black Athena." And David Gress writes in the New Criterion, "Who would have thought it possible to enlist the Bronze Age Greece in the current academic war against Western civilization? What would be at stake would be nothing less than the distortion and dismantling of higher education, which would be exactly the intention of the author Martin Bernal." Wow, I was completely shocked. Why would Bernal's argument that the ancient Greek learned a lot from the Egyptians be an attack on Western civilization? Could it be that here is someone shrieking who has the mindset of the Clash of Civilization crowd? We will see. Let's look at the different aspects of a very complex question. Let's go back to Nicolaus of Cusa's statement that Moses and Plato learned very essential truths from Hermes Trismegistus. All the academics agree that Hermes Trismegistus was identical with the Egyptian god Thot. And even modern authors don't deny his role as god of wisdom and knowledge. First slide, please. Here you have a relief from the 19th dynasty during Ramses II, which is about 1250 BC. These reliefs and paintings are one of the most beautiful wall decorations of the New Kingdom. What you see here is the vignette of verse 94 of the book, the so-called Book of the Dead, where the god Thot, with the head of Ibis, gives the riding set and a water pot to Neferati. Next slide. This is the god Thot at the judgment of the dead. This is again the 19th dynasty, 1285 BC. This is in the British Museum. This is a vignette to verse 125 of the Book of the Dead, where Hunifer is guided by the shekel-faced god Anubis to the trial, and his heart is weighed against the symbol of truth, the feather. If the feather has the same weight as the heart of the just died person, it is proof that he has lived a life according to the laws. Besides the scale, to the right, you have the god Thoth, the god of wisdom, with the ibis head, and he writes the result of the weighing. The script names Thoth as the master of the divine words. So the big controversy erupts concerning the age of the writings combined with the so-called Corpus Hermeticus, which are texts possibly dating back to this god Thoth, and possibly many of them being attributed, being written much later. So it's, if these texts, the big controversy is if these texts are reflecting the ancient Egyptian philosophy or if they originated in classical Greece. And also controversy erupts concerning the person of Thoth, who is called Hermes in Greek, and his role. Admittedly, the borderline between the undeniable very old tradition of Thoth in Egypt and the philosophy of the Hermetic texts are fluent, and it is very difficult to come to definite conclusions from an archaeological, from a philological standpoint. Fact is that until the writings of the French Protestant Isaac Casaubon in the beginning of the 17th century, all thinkers who referred to Hermes Trismegistus and the Hermetic writings as Egyptian. Casaubon proved the philosophical, theological, and even literal cohesion between the Hermetic texts, Plato, and the New Testaments, to then argue that that could only mean that the Hermetic writings had to be written after the emergence of Christianity in Greece, namely in the 2nd and 4th century DC. But one can also take the opposite view, that this cohesion rather gives credence to St. Augustine and Nicolaus of Cusa's argument that there is no contradiction between the universal human truth and Christianity. Either Plato's ideas are identical with Egyptian tradition, or they originate there. Let's look at the different aspects.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with more of our presentation of Part 1 of Helga LaRouche on the Dialogue of Cultures, presented at the 2002 President's Day Conference of the Schiller Institute. Back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with more of Helga LaRouche at the President's Day Conference of the Schiller Institute, February 17, 2002.
In Plato's Phaedos, Socrates says, he, Thoth, was the one who created the numbers, mathematics, and geometry, and especially all the letters, the hieroglyphs. What is clear is the idea that Thoth was the originator of writings, of wisdom, and that he is referred to several times in the so-called Book of the Dead, which was especially widely distributed in the 18th dynasty, which was the 16th and 14th century BC. There are also references from the 19th dynasty, which speak of the writings of Thoth, and that Thoth was described as an extremely powerful deity. Newer discoveries, which indicate that at least elements of the Hermetic writings can be dated definitely much earlier. In Esna, in Upper Egypt, the name Thoth, who is also called the three times greatest, were found from the 3rd century BC. And Trismegistus means the thrice great firmness. They are also found in the so-called Demotic texts from Sakarana near Memphis from the 2nd century BC. An extremely interesting text called the Memphis Theology from the 2nd or 3rd millennium BC contains a cosmogony where Ptah, the god of Memphis, and Atum, his emanation, appeared as the first beings. Ptah created the universe with his heart, the location of his intellect, and realized it through the tongue in the act of speaking. Again, a similarity with the account of the original creation you can find in Plato and in the first book of John. Remember, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, is obvious. Even James Breasted from the University of Chicago, who otherwise opposed the views of Philo of Alexandria and Schiller on Egypt, wrote after the publication of the translation of the Memphis Theology in 1901. This conception of the Word represents a sufficient basis for the assumption that the notion of nous, the mind, and logos, the Word, of which one up to now believed that they were introduced to Egypt at a much later point, already existed in the much earlier period. With this, the Greek record that the origin of Greek philosophy has to be looked for in Egypt has obviously much more truth to it than one is willing to admit in modern times. In the cosmogony, Tot played the role of the heart of Ptah, while the tongue is Horus. This tradition, which connects Tot with the heart, is still 2,000 years later in the Treasure of Ha. John Ray, who published these texts, emphasizes the association of the heart with the intellect with Tot is associated. Isn't that a similar idea like we found it in the fourth verse of the Vedic creation song, that the intellect and the heart belong together? It seems that the Corpus Hermeticus was written over a very long period of time, probably using older traditions being written up then between the 6th century BC until the 2nd century DC, AD, but it surely contains the religious and philosophical ideas of much earlier Egyptian times. Concerning the Greek influences, which are also there, it remains to be investigated further, since much of the Pythagorean and Platonic philosophy had a strong Egyptian influence in the first place. In this period, there was also what is called euhemerization, namely the transformation of the gods into sages, but that the person of Hermes Trismegistus continued to be referenced in both Christianity and Islam as an epitome of knowledge. Before we return to the question of why the argument that Greek philosophy is based on Egyptian influence, let's look at the Greek and Renaissance thinkers themselves, how they saw this question. Martin Bernal assumes that there were waves of colonization, not only of Crete, but also of Greece in the 2nd millennium BC. And why would there have been a break to this tradition? Plato describes in the Timaeus and the Critias that the early civilization of Atlantis and how it was destroyed. This probably refers to the destruction of the volcano island Terra in 1625 BC. In the very famous account about Atlantis, Critias tells the following story. Solon, who lived 640 to 560 BC, would have visited Sais, then the capital of Egypt, in the early 6th century, where he would have been received like a family member, because there was a close relationship between Sais and Athens. And a high-ranking Egyptian priest scolded Solon with the famous words, "O Solon, Solon, you Greeks are nothing but children, and there is not one adult Greek," which seems to reflect that Plato saw Egypt as the older culture, and maybe the old Egyptians looked at the Greek as the baby boomers of the time. Then Plato explains why the Athenians had so little knowledge of their own past, which would be due to the fact that Greek culture again and again was destroyed through fires and floods, the famous Dark Age, so that no memory of Athens' earlier glory would exist. In Egypt, because of its better location, a very old institutions and records would have been preserved over long periods of time. Therefore, anybody who wanted to find out about the early periods of the Athenians had to go to Egypt. He also reports that many people like Solon, Pythagoras, but also Pelops, Cadmos, Aegyptos, Danaos, would have brought ideas and cultural goods from Egypt. Now let's take a look briefly at some later thinkers on the same question. A church writer called Cecilius Firminianus Lactantius, who died in 317 AD, called Hermes wrote that Hermes lived before Moses, and Philo of Alexandria, who lived in the first century, tried to connect the Hermetic thinking with the Old Testament and the Platonic thought. Abelard referred to the Hermetic writings to again make the point Augustinus had made earlier, how deeply the philosophers had understood the secrets of God, and that God is not only good, but he is the good itself, and that he, as a world-creating wisdom, produces the entirety of ideas, and that he moves the totality of the world in a loving way. These basic principles of a philosophical teaching of the Trinity, Abelard already found in Hermes Trismegistus, as well as Augustine and Plato, whom he calls the greatest philosopher. A similar notion of Trinity we find with Raymond Lullus, who lived in Mallorca, who described God as the creator, deificans, the created one, deificabilis, and the actual process of creation, deificare. Nicolaus of Cus, who knew Lull since his studies in Padua, tries to prove the Trinity in a philosophical way, and he sees himself in the tradition of Hermes and the Neoplatonics, about who Augustinus already said that they would have philosophically comprehended the Trinity. Also, influence of Hermes, of Hermetic writings, you find in Albert the Great in the 13th century, who speaks of the Egyptian wisdom of Hermes. Man is through intellect the bond, the tie between God and the world, says Albert. The English mathematician and philosopher Thomas Brett Wardine, who died in 1349, spoke of Hermes as the father of philosophers Trismegistus Triplex, the three times great Trismegistus, the philosophical Pater Maximum, the greatest father, the Rex Aegypti, the king of Egypt, the philosopher and the prophet. Ficino translated in 1463 on the request of Cosimo de' Medici, the great sponsor of the Renaissance in Florence, the entire Hermetic writings, which thus had been brought by monks from Macedonia, even before several of Plato's dialogue, out of respect for the older sources. So these translations, the idea got strengthened that there is a universal original wisdom available in all of universal history. Also, Ficino wanted to prove the unity of Christianity, Platonism, and the Hermetic tradition. And naturally, Giordano Bruno said, we Greek, calling himself a Greek because he was in this tradition, thank to the Egyptian the great monarchy of education and intellectual nobility, that she is the ancestor of our fables, metaphors, and teachings. Now, Bruno was burned alive for these beliefs. Still in the 17th century, the German Jesuit Athanasius Kircher wrote, Hermes Trismegistus, who introduced as the first one the hieroglyphs, and in this way became the prince and ancestor of all Egyptian theology and philosophy, was the first and oldest among all the Egyptians, and from him learned Orpheus, Musaios, Linos, Pythagoras, Plato, Eudoxus, Parmenides, Melissus, Homer, Euripides, and others, all what they knew about God and the divine. Coming back to Bernal's book, in which he makes the point that this ancient model of Greek history, which the Greeks themselves in the classical and Hellenistic period regarded to be their own history, was replaced by what he calls the Aryan model, which first came up in the first half of the 19th century, and actually starting in the 18th century. Where I fully agree with Bernal is the thesis that for the racists and the romantics of the 18th and 19th century, the thought was unbearable that Greece, the cradle of European civilization, was a mixture of European and Egyptian, namely African and Asian and Semitic colonialists. Knowing, and I studied this very intensively, how the Romantics worked hard to replace the Greek classic through a strange mix of fantasy, Middle Age conceptions mixed with Nordic mythologies, changing the history of ideas with a blood and soil identity combined with racism, and you know how this was the basis for the different colonial empires, I think the case is clear. The absolutely amazing thing is that if one reads Greek history and philosophy, they absolutely ignore the Egyptian side. According to Greek history, Hermes Trismegistus is Greek, and the Egyptologists have nothing to say about it. Also, if one reads in Renaissance philosophy or Plato secondary literature, even the names of Hermes Trismegistus is present, the secondary literature almost never mentions the Egyptian background to these ideas. It is quite something. You have first history which is European, and then secondly you have a history which is Egyptian, and the experts of both sides pretend the other one does not exist. Further absurd is the issue obscured is the issue obviously by the fact that various strange sects and tendencies trace themselves back to the Egyptian history and philosophy, especially since the 17th century, the Rosicrucians and various Freemasonics and modern-day esoterics. Despite the fact that some of the most important archaeological breakthroughs occurred in the 19th century, such as the deciphering of the hieroglyphs by Champollion, next slide, please. Here you have the famous Rosetta Stone, which was found 196 BC in the Ptolemaic Kingdom, and what it describes is the 18th day of the second winter month in the ninth year of the reign of King Ptolemaeus V, who, when the priests in Memphis released a decree concerning the crowning of the just 14-year-old king who had come from Macedonia. Now, you have three different types of writing. One is the Greek, which is the official language. Then you have, secondly, the demotic language, the popular language of the time by the Egyptians. But the sacred texts are also written in the old hieroglyphs, and they are all on one single stele, which was discovered in 1798 during Napoleon's campaign to Egypt in a port city called El Rashid. This stele, despite the fact that it's 762 kilograms heavy, was robbed and brought to the British Museum, and where later Champollion got a copy, and he could actually decipher the hieroglyphs on the basis of this. Secondly, one of the discoveries of the 19th century was the discovery of Troja by Heinrich Schliemann and the Linear B script by Michael Ventris, which were all groundbreaking events. It is nevertheless true that from the late 18th to the 19th century to the 20th century, the question of Egyptian influence on ancient Greek became more ideologicalized. It is very obvious that the British dislike for Egypt, and Sudan for that matter, increased with their occupation of this country. And even if there were decent archaeologists in England, such as William Matthew Flinders Petrie, the various racist or Aryan views a la Gobineau became increasingly dominant. Typical is a quote mentioned by Bernal of the English Egyptologist Wallis Budge. The Egyptians, in their essence, an African people, had all the advantages and shortcomings which are characteristic of the African race in general. And one cannot assume for one instant that any African people would be capable to develop a metaphysics in the modern sense. And against the German Egyptologist Heinrich Brugsch, who took the chair of archaeology in Göttingen in 1868, and who argued that the ancient Egyptians had developed monotheism, Butch wrote, "It is very difficult to understand how an excellent Egyptologist would try to compare the image of God of Hellenized Africans with what such cultivated nations as the Greek and the Romans have developed." Now, how cultivated the Romans were, we all know. There is no question that the whole issue of Egyptian influence on Greece and therefore Europe is completely clouded by this form of naked racism, and that therefore Martin Bernal's efforts are totally legitimate, even if in his justified anger he makes the mistake to equate what he calls European arrogance with the views of the colonialists, ignoring the humanist tradition. After his book Black Athena came out in 1987, all kinds of plenary sessions took place in all historical associations, at the annual meeting of the principal American classical and Egyptian Egyptological organizations, the American Philological Association, and the American Research Center in Cairo to all discuss the merits of this book. Over 70 articles appeared in newspapers and magazines, and thousands are on the internet still to the present day. It's one of the most controversial issues. And one of the most freaked out articles with the title Not Out of Africa was written by a certain Mary Lefkowitz. It was supposed to be a devastating attack on what she considered to be an Afrocentric or even Nilocentric view. She not only tries to dismantle Bernal's argument, but also attacks the following authors: Frederick Douglass, Edward Blyden, W.E.B. Du Bois, John Hendrick Clarke, Sheik Anta Diop, Joseph Ben Yoshanan, and George G.M. James for their view that Afro-Americans have anything to do with ancient Egypt. Why should one care about Mary Lefkowitz? Because what she engages in is not just some academic debate. In the preface of Not Out of Africa, she thanks the Welsby College, the Bradley Foundation, the Olin Foundation for their grants. Now here we have closure. What a surprise. Behind this whole debate, you have the clash of civilization crowned. Now, if you read the new EIR report, which was also discussed last night, on the background of the 11th September events, then you find a profile of these foundations, and you also understand why they put so much effort in distort history, because this is essential for their policy of the clash of civilization, because they depend on keeping cultures completely separated, denying completely the continuity of ideas and of universal principles. Instead, they want to reduce the population to the different races with blood and soil identities who by definition are pitched against each other. Against this apparent control game, which loses its power once it is demasked, we set the dialogue of civilizations, where we refer to the best traditions of each culture and we relate to it from that standpoint of what the culture contributed to the progress of universal history. So we start with an image of man, which is the common identity of all human beings on this planet, the cognitive aspect of man, which differentiates mankind from all other beings. That which is the cognitive aspect of man in what we call in Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, man in the image of God, in the image of God, the Creator. In Hinduism, a similar idea exists where man partakes in God's nature. That which makes man in the image of God, the Creator, is his creative reason, his ability to formulate hypotheses about the physical universe again and again. If these hypotheses are adequate, they lead to new discoveries, and then how these laws of nature function, and this is called scientific progress. If these scientific discoveries are applied in the production process, we call this technological progress, which increases the productivity of the labor force and of the productive capacity of the productive process. The effect of this on the economy is that it increases the living standard of the population, its longevity, and an increase in the potential relative population density of the Earth, as Mr. LaRouche has called it. The late Russian scientist Boris Kuznetsov, a famous Russian scientist in the tradition of Mendeleev and Vernadsky, was so impressed with LaRouche's method of physical economy, and especially the concept of the relative potential population density as a measurement of the economic processes, that he predicted that the measuring unit of how to judge economic processes would soon be called the La, after La Rouge, like the Ampere or the Watt, which are named after these discoveries. So whenever man is truly human, meaning creative, when his power of cognition is efficient, you have progress in universal history. Now, if you look back at universal history with the eyes of Friedrich Schiller, namely that it took thousands and thousands of generations and their struggles and contributions to get us to our moment in history, if one glances back in history in this way, one realizes that this progress is not the property of one culture or civilization, nor nation, but that the torch of progress was carried by different cultures at different times. There may have been before and during the last ice age a very advanced transoceanic culture. There are many indications for such an assumption. After the ice age, with the melting of the ice around 10,000 BC, there was the development of different cultures which reflected the transoceanic culture from during the ice age. The organizing of life depended on the sea culture, and migration occurred in all likelihood in large flotillas of ships after the ice melted, and then people would make it up in large up large rivers on which they would travel by boat. There were four cradles of mankind in China, India, Mesopotamia, and Egypt. In India, the Vedic and Upanishad period represented a very high level. And there the Vedic calendars were developed according to Tilak between 6000 and 4000 BC. He could calculate that because that was the time when the spring equinox was in the Orion. So the dating of these calendars was relatively easy. In China, there was about since 5000 BC, in the so-called Jia period from 2205 BC, and the Shang and the Ying dynasty in the 16th to the 11th century, very important civilizations. And then later, naturally, Confucianism, Mencianism contributed to universal history. In Egypt, the so-called Old Empire, especially the Third Dynasty from 2665 to 2595, the great inventor Djoser, who was the builder of the large pyramids, which show a very high level of scientific and cultural development, represent a benchmark. And nothing of the same period compares with that. Next slide. In the 19th century, in 1340, 1340 BC, this beautiful head of Nofretete was created by an artist. This is now in the Egyptian Museum in Berlin. And as you can see, this has an unbelievable beauty, which obviously reflects the soul of the artist. I mean, anybody who created this in 1340 must have had an image of man which was just incredibly beautiful. There is even a little sign in the museum in Berlin that this fits today's beauty ideal. Then, next slide, you have the gold mask of Tutanchamun from about 1325 BC. And again, this is an unbelievably beautiful face where I cannot say if it's African or European or Asian or maybe a mixture of all of these. In any case, it can again only come from the beauty of the image of the artist. When this picture was shown for the first time in 1817 in the British Museum, it caused a world sensation because of its beauty, because it obviously violated all the prejudices that all the Egyptians were ugly and so forth. Then, after Alexander the Great conquered Egypt and created the Library of Alexandria, the center of Egyptian Greek studies for a long time, this presented a next step of progress.
You've been listening to EIR Talks, presenting Helga Zeplerush at the Schiller Institute's President's Day Conference. To replay this program or to read the full transcript of the conference, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.